All right, I'd like you to take your Bibles this morning and turn to Romans chapter 8. When we do it God's way, He wants us to be the head and not the tail. In the next two messages, we're going to talk more about how and the kingdom will be ours once again.
Welcome to Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. The focus of this ministry is to open the eyes of our people and give insight into the issues we find ourselves facing in this day and age. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scotts Bluff, Nebraska 69363, or you can reach us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here is Ted Weiland.
Okay, 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3 through 6. I'm going to read it from the today's English version, and I'm not so sure now that I've looked at this version that I don't like this version best of all. Again, 2 Corinthians chapter 10, beginning with verse 3, TEV. It is true that we live in the world, but we do not fight from worldly motives. I think I like that first verse because it doesn't take us out of the world as if the world isn't important. We're to be the light of the world and the salt of the earth, of course. He says it is true that we live in the world, but we do not fight from worldly motives. The weapons we use in our fight are not the world's weapons, but God's powerful weapons, which we use to destroy strongholds. We destroy false arguments, we pull down every proud obstacle that is raised against the knowledge of God, and we take every thought captive and make it obey Christ. And after you have proved your complete loyalty, we will be ready to punish any act of disloyalty. This will be Word Wars and Captive Thoughts, Part 16. In the last two messages, we've been reclaiming or recapturing our God-delegated, immutable responsibilities versus God, quote-unquote, God-given, inalienable rights. As described, of course, in both the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution's preamble. Before moving on, let me refer to or mention something concerning the term inalienable. A couple times now, in fact, just yesterday, and a couple years ago, somebody corrected me and said it's not inalienable, it's unalienable, particularly as it concerns the Declaration of Independence. And if you go to the Declaration of Independence, in fact, it is not spelled I-N, but U-N, unalienable rights. However, and I thought, well, I'm just wrong, but if you look up unalienable in the dictionary, at least in the dictionary I have, it doesn't even give a definition. It just simply refers you to inalienable. They are, therefore, essentially one and the same thing. I think probably inalienable is simply the more modern term versus something a little bit more archaic. Now, the reason I think that you see, particularly patriots and the legal types, want to use unalienable is because they're pronouncing it as unalienable rights, something that cannot be, a lien cannot be put against. And there's probably some validity in pronouncing it that way, although that's not the pronunciation for those letters. It's unalienable or inalienable. But they're basically one and the same thing. Here's the definition. Provided, at least one definition provided for inalienable, quote, incapable of being alienated. The guy yesterday, and I thought, well, maybe so. He says, well, what do aliens have to do with it? Well, they don't have anything to do with it. It means incapable of being alienated, surrendered, or transferred. They are inalienable or unalienable rights. At least that's what's claimed about them. Part of recapturing this whole idea concerning this area is the fact that we have been totally bamboozled that these are inalienable or unalienable or unalienable rights that cannot be surrendered, cannot be taken from us. Well, they're taken from us all the time. Ask the life in the womb, the millions of lives in the wombs who have the right to life, the unalienable right to life. Ask them if their rights are unalienable and cannot be taken from them by any government. Baloney. And so we've been, in the last two messages, recapturing the whole idea God-given immutable responsibilities as provided for in the Scriptures versus the man-made concept of quote-unquote God-given unalienable or inalienable rights. In particular, we've discussed the alleged right to life that I just referred to. There is no alleged right to life. The alleged right to religious liberty we dealt with in the last message, and if you'll recall, we even dealt with liberty or freedom itself, and demonstrated that none of these, nor any of the other so-called rights, provided or supposedly secured in the Constitution's preamble and protected by the Bill of Rights, are in any fashion rights provided to us by Yahweh or the God of the Bible, but are instead merely rights claimed by the constitutional republic's substitute God, we the people. Oh, they're claimed by that God. They're claimed by we the people. But they're certainly not rights given to us in any fashion by Yahweh. The entire idea of unalienable rights is therefore flawed, if for no other reason than because they do not come from Yahweh or His perfect laws, as much admitted to by Alexander Hamilton in his pamphlet, The Farmer Refuted, printed in 1775, he made the following statement. He said, quote, "The sacred rights of mankind," catch that term, that's an important term, "the sacred rights of mankind are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty records," end of quote. Now, he wasn't referring specifically, I don't think. He may have been in his mind to include it. But certainly within that statement, it's inclusive then of what could be described as old parchments or certainly musty records as originally found in the original manuscripts of the Scriptures. It's an all-inclusive statement. And he says that's not where these sacred rights of mankind, I don't know that the Bible talks about any sacred rights, of rights period, let alone sacred rights of mankind. Quoting Blackstone, Hamilton also shared the following from Blackstone, quote, "The first and primary end of human laws," that's what we're talking about, human laws, natural rights, sacred human rights. "The first and primary end of human laws is to maintain and regulate these absolute rights to individuals," end of quote. Well, that may be the primary end of human laws, but that's not what we should be questioning here. It's whether it's the primary end of Yahweh's laws. We're talking human rights. That's just another term for the same thing. Not with roots in the Bible, but instead, where do you think they have their roots? Human rights. Natural rights. How about the Age of Enlightenment? That's where they have their roots. And you can look it up. Look up the history of unalienable rights, and that's what you'll find is the case. They definitely have at least some of their roots found in the Age of Enlightenment. Part and parcel of the Age of Enlightenment's nature's God that you often hear the founder, quote-unquote founders of this country, the framers of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, they are part and parcel of the Age of Enlightenment's nature's God, which also cannot be found in Yahweh's word. It was a common term they used. Where did they get it? They didn't get it from the Bible. The Bible speaks nothing of the nature's God. But nonetheless, they did try. You'll often find them trying, Blackstone in particular is the one who's so often quoted, of trying to tie this nature's God into the Bible, let alone that particular term and what it refers to certainly is not a biblical term. Nature's God, nature's laws, they are essentially bound together and integral with each other. Now, having said that, another of the assumed natural right, natural or human, quote-unquote, unalienable rights that we hear about all of the time is the Second Amendment's, quote-unquote, right of the people to bear arms in protection of themselves, their families, and others. And with the January 10th Arizona shootings in which a mental wacko by the name of Jared Loughner shot and killed 6 people and wounded 13 others, there is some, I won't even go there, but who shot and killed 6 people and wounded 13 others, the airwaves and internet with that shooting here just last week, the airwaves and internet are once again abuzz, inundated with Second Amendment debates once again. Those on the quote-unquote right are defending Second Amendment rights. And those on the quote-unquote left, and the reason, of course, I put them in quotes, the right and the left, they're all left. They're just right. Some are right-left and some are left-left. But so the quote, we're putting quotes around it just to make sure that we understand we're not talking about a literal right and left here, because they're both left of Yahweh's morality as found in His laws. So again, those on the quote-unquote right are defending Second Amendment rights, whereas those on the quote-unquote left are essentially condemning Second Amendment rights. And already, those on the quote-unquote left, the left-left, have intentions to introduce new legislation by which those quote-unquote rights will be further curtailed. And if history is an indicator, which it usually is, of what will occur, that is precisely what is going to happen. And the debate over the Second Amendment right to bear arms will once again, continue to rage on, and the left, quote-unquote left, will continue to blame the quote-unquote right for future shootings. And the quote-unquote right will continue to blame the quote-unquote left for their incremental but nonetheless progressive loss of their Second Amendment rights. It'll simply continue to go on as it's been going on for some time. And the ironic thing about this debate is that both the quote-unquote left and the quote-unquote right are correct. That's right. I said that even the left's accusations that the right is to blame for such shootings, past, present, and future, is correct. And as sure as I'm standing here, there will be people incredulously asking, how can I say such a thing? And my answer to their question is once again Isaiah 5, verse 13, 20, and 24. Let me read it to you again. Verse 13, therefore my people have gone into captivity, if not literally, then mentally and spiritually. Therefore my people are gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. Verse 20, they call evil good and good evil. Sometimes it's just different percentages of the doing that, particularly when they're all on the left and fighting each other. They call evil good and good evil, and put darkness for light and light for darkness. They put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Verse 24, because they have cast away the law of Yahweh of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. End of quote. Now, in light of Isaiah 5, and because nearly everyone on the quote-unquote right, patriot, Christian, pronomian, and I probably should put quotes around all of those as well, patriot, Christian, pronomian, and otherwise, have to one extent or another cast away the law of Yahweh of hosts. On this issue, like so many others, their thoughts have been taken captive. So we're not just talking about the left-left, we're talking about the right-left. Because even they, to one extent or another, have cast away the law of Yahweh of hosts, their thoughts, I guarantee you, on this issue, although we may seem to associate better with them than the others, but their thoughts, I assure you, and hopefully you will see by the end of this message, have been taken captive as well. And thus, the entire debate on this issue has been because they've rejected Yahweh's morality as found in His laws, and because therefore their thoughts have been taken captive, the entire debate has been framed incorrectly. And as framed, no one wins. It's Hegelian dialectics, by which both sides of the debate, the thesis and the antithesis, has been provided us, and by which a desired and perhaps even a predetermined end, the synthesis, is achieved. They frame the argument, they give both sides of the argument, and they end up with what they want, in other words. In other words, the current debate regarding Second Amendment rights is the wrong debate. That is, provided you accept Yahweh's perfect laws and altogether righteous judgments as your paradigm, as the only standard by which everything must be judged. Consequently, the real debate, the one we, at least Christians, should be having, is one that should be framed from Yahweh's laws, inspired by Yahweh, rather than the Bill of Rights inspired by the Age of Enlightenment. And this will hopefully prove to be a lesson to all of us that before entering any debate, to make certain that you're in the right debate to begin with, to make sure the debate has been defined by the right parameters, that is, Yahweh's commandments, statutes, and judgments, if that is your paradigm. If you haven't cast away that paradigm and therefore have no choice but to follow whatever argument and debate whatever argument it is from their parameters rather than His. Regrettably, most Christians are letting non-Christians shape the debate from non-biblical parameters. In other words, more often than not, Christians are playing their game by their rules instead of ours, or better yet, Yahweh's, by Yahweh and by His rules. Furthermore, most Christians are so Bible law illiterate that even if within the right within the right parameters, they would still be incapable of effectually arguing Yahweh's laws. So it's not just a matter of, well, it is in both cases. We've got to get back to His laws. We have got to become experts in His morality as found in His laws, so that we not only frame the right argument, but that we can then argue effectively therein by those very same parameters. Part and parcel of taking every thought captive, this is really so essential that it's foundational, is framing and debating the correct argument. That is, based upon and from within biblical parameters. And the Second Amendment argument is not one of those. To argue from any other paradigm is to already lose the debate. Case in point, the proper debate regarding bearing arms is not one of Second Amendment rights or no Second Amendment rights, or of the inalienable, quote-unquote, right of the people to bear arms in defense of themselves and others. Arguing from those parameters, which nearly everyone does today, places Christians in a debate which, as demonstrated by history, cannot be won. It's already a lost battle. Second Amendment rights have not been secured or even maintained from those parameters, but have instead been incrementally and progressively lost. Why? Because the debate itself is fundamentally flawed, at least when you understand the right parameters. Instead, the debate that we should be having is one regarding the inalienable, quote-unquote, right to bear arms versus the immutable responsibility to bear arms in defense of ourselves, our families, and neighbor. Again, it's not a question. It is not a question of constitutional rights, but biblical responsibilities. At least that's what it should be for the Christian, and particularly the pronomian Christian, if that's what he's going to claim. And yet, again, so many of even the pronomian Christians, their whole argument is based upon Second Amendment, quote-unquote, rights instead of biblical responsibilities. You and I, let's talk about the biblical parameters. Let's look at it from the biblical parameters. You and I, particularly as men, as the head of our homes and all that comes with that, do, listen to me, think about this, do not have the right to bear arms in defense of our families as if it's a choice for us to take or leave, being that rights can be exercised or not exercised. What an absolutely preposterous idea. And it seems like nobody's ever thought of that. And are you beginning to see the foundational problems with this whole argument of trying to claim your Second Amendment or any rights whatsoever? We don't have the right, but the responsibility to bear arms in defense of ourselves and our families. In fact, according to 1 Timothy 5:8, as it pertains to our families, we are worse than an infidel if we do not do so. It's not a right. It's a responsibility that if we do not fulfill, Yahweh says we're worse than an infidel. 1 Timothy 5:8, for those who may not be familiar with it, it says, but if any provide not for his own. Well, that should begin with spiritual protection. But it certainly would apply to physical protection as well, and whatever else is entailed therein. And what does it say? But if any provide not for his own, including physical protection, and especially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. End of quote. The same holds true not only for our families, but the same holds true as it concerns the well-being and protection of our neighbors. First, you know, don't forget that we're to love our neighbor as ourself, which means that if I would protect myself and what's mine from plunderers and rapists and murderers, at the very least, I owe my neighbor the same consideration, the same protection, right? Now, let's look at a couple passages that also tell us the same thing as it concerns our neighbor. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 22. Deuteronomy chapter 22, and let's read verses 1 through 4. Verse 1, thou shalt not see thy brother's ox or his sheep go astray, and hide thyself from them. Thou shalt in any case bring them again unto thy brother. And if thy brother be not nigh unto thee, or if thou not know him not, then thou shalt bring it unto thine own house, and it shall be with thee until thy brother seek after it, and thou shalt restore it to him again. In like manner shalt thou do with his ass or his donkey, and so shalt thou do with his raiment, and with all lost thing of thy brother's which he has lost, and thou hast found, shalt thou do likewise. Thou mayest not hide thyself. Verse 4. Thou shalt not see thy brother's ass or his ox fall down by the way, and hide thyself from them. Thou shalt surely help to lift them up again. Now, having read that, someone may, and maybe very likely, respond that there is nothing therein regarding defending one's neighbor. Well, sure there is. Do you think Yahweh's more concerned about a person's donkey than he is a donkey's person? Of course, we are to love our neighbor at least as much as we do our neighbor's donkey, don't you think? That is, unless, of course, we only love ourselves as much as a donkey. But otherwise, we got to love him at least as much as a donkey, and obviously more as well. In principle, Deuteronomy 22:1-4 includes the implied obligation for the life and well-being of our neighbor as well. Either it's that, or you got to say that God's more concerned about donkeys than he is about people. We are indeed, from that implied passage, we are indeed our brother's keeper. God intends us to be each other's keeper, even those that we don't know, even a stranger. And in fact, those same laws are applied by Christ and even within the law itself to even our enemies. That we're to come to the aid of our enemies. If his donkey's in the ditch and under a load and can't get up, you're to stop and you're to help him. This bystander duty, which includes rendering assistance against criminals who would attack our neighbors, is alluded to later in this same chapter. Turn with me to Deuteronomy 22, beginning with verse 23, reading through 27. It says, if a damsel, that is a virgin, be betrothed unto a husband, and a man find her in the city and lie with her, then you shall bring them both out under the gate of that city, and you shall stone them with stones that they die, the damsel because she cried not being in the city. In other words, it's implied that if she had cried, being there's people all around, people would have heard her. And the man, because he has humbled his neighbor's wife, so thou shalt put away evil from among you. But if a man find a betrothed damsel in the field, and the man force her and lie with her, then the man only that lay with her shall die. But unto the damsel thou shalt do nothing. There is in the damsel no sin worthy of death. For as when a man riseth against his neighbor and slayeth him, even so is this matter. For he found her in the field, and the betrothed damsel cried, and there was none to save her. Now, the unstated implication in all of that is that if a woman cries out, and it would apply to a man as well, under other circumstances, that any man, the implied implication is that if a woman cries out in such a situation, any man within earshot is to come to her rescue. And thus, an eyewitness to a crime has an obligation, a debt, if you will, to both the victim and society in general. It's not his right to intervene. He is duty-bound to intervene and to do whatever is necessary to stop the perpetrator, including taking his life if required. If a woman is being raped and you hear her cry, and the only thing that will stop the man is to kill him, then you're duty bound. It's not a right for you to do that you can exercise or to choose not to exercise. You are duty bound to do whatever it takes in such a situation, as did Moses. in Exodus chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, when he was witness to a fellow Israelite being beat to death, and he intervened on his neighbor's behalf by taking the law into his own hands. When in the act of a crime, when it is witnessed, particularly by men, within earshot or eyesight, they have the not the right, but the responsibility to take the law into their own hands. If it's after the fact, then it has to go through a biblical court of law, but not while the act is being perpetuated. In other words, here's the point. In other words, or at least one of the points, last week, when those three Arizona men intervened and subdued Loftner, one of whom had a concealed pistol, which he says he was prepared to use to kill Loftner had it been necessary. It was not their inalienable right to do so. It was their immutable responsibility to do what they did, and every other man there witnessing the same. And just imagine how many crimes would be averted in this country if thieves, rapists, murderers, and potential criminals knew that every Christian man within earshot or eyesight of a crime stands ready to do whatever is necessary to stop any and all wrongdoers in their crimes. Think about that. And how many, by that fact alone, how many crimes would be averted? How many less women would be raped today? How many less murderers there would be? How many less thieves and every other crime imaginable, kidnappings and anything else you want to add to the list? If they knew that every single Christian man was ready to do whatever was required to stop them in their tracks, how much more so if every law-abiding, able-bodied man, as part of this God-given responsibility, was also required to carry a firearm for his own, his family's, and his neighbor's protection? If you think about that, this would also eliminate almost completely the need for a tax-paid, hired police force. Just a residual benefit of doing it God's way. Which, by the way, speaking of the police force, according to the Supreme Court decision in town of Castle Rock, Colorado versus Jessica Gonzalez and other Supreme Court decisions, the police force, according to those decisions, have no obligation whatsoever to protect American citizens in the first place. If they happen to be there, which is very seldom the case at the time, they're usually just the cleanup crew. But if they happen to be there, they have no obligation to do anything. It's simply their choice if they decide to do so. Tragically, federal and state governments alike, practically speaking, have all but stripped citizens of their responsibility to intervene, with the exception of those who petition and jump through the government's hoops to secure a concealed weapons permit. And keep in mind that one of the definitions of a permit or a license is the permission to do what the government otherwise considers illegal. Not unlawful, that's God's realm, but what the government otherwise considers illegal, or a right that they have the right to license and control. Making a criminal out of anyone who otherwise fulfills their biblical responsibilities. It's called calling good evil and evil good. It's called making illegal what is lawful and even required by Yahweh, and making unlawful, in many cases, legal. How did the government, I ask you to consider this, how did the government accomplish this means that we just described, this means of constraint and control? How did, when it comes to the responsibilities that every Christian man has according to God. Well, not through. They weren't able to control this through the immutable biblical responsibility. That's not how they controlled this. But through the Constitution's so-called inalienable right. That's how they were able to control this. They don't want people looking at this from an immutable responsibility, particularly one given from Yahweh. They don't want vigilantes. They want the power to decide who and when situations are, someone can intervene. What Americans need to understand is that it's much easier to regulate and restrict a person's rights, particularly when secured by the government, a la the preamble of the United States Constitution, than it is. It's much easier to regulate and restrict a person's rights than it is a responsibility commissioned by Yahweh. And that they also need to understand in all of this, which the two go together, is that rights, call them unalienable if you want, but rights can be taken away unalienable or otherwise, and incrementally have been and continue to be taken away. And most patriots know this. Most patriots know this. They call them unalienable rights, but they know that they have been incrementally, have and continue to be taken away, and are outright outraged over the fact of it. But listen, yelling and screaming and expressing your outrage on internet blogs and petitioning your congressman hasn't and isn't going to stop this from happening. Certainly hasn't in the past, and there's no reason to believe that it's going to in the future. In other words, the answer to losing our rights is not found in demanding our unbiblical, unalienable, quote-unquote, rights. That's what's got us into this mess. Instead, the answer is dumping the whole idea of unbiblical rights, of age of reasoning's rights, and in recognizing, affirming, and fulfilling our God-given, God-expected, immutable responsibilities. Whereas rights, in or unalienable or otherwise, can be taken from us, responsibilities are immutable. They're absolute. That's what they are. That is, if they are derived from Yahweh, the creator and sustainer of the universe, then they're immutable. He doesn't take away his responsibilities. They are, in fact, absolute. And if that's where they come from, and if you truly consider his authority above all other authority, recognizing that any authority not under or not in accord with his authority is no authority at all, but is instead an impostor or a usurper. If you believe that, and you recognize that that's where your authority for your responsibilities come from, then in fact they are immutable. Until then, Congress will continue to use isolated cases such as Loeffner's, that is, individual irresponsible firearms use, to whittle away the Second Amendment, quote-unquote, rights of responsible users. This is why to argue from a Second Amendment or a rights position is to lose the debate before it's even engaged. There is no winning when arguing from their paradigm. This is also why our God-commissioned responsibility to bear arms in defense of ourselves and others alone is not enough, It's going to go a long ways. But it's not enough to completely guarantee a safe and secure society. It must be enforced by judicial judgment for any irresponsible, unlawful use of the same. Which means, if convicted of murder in a biblical court, regardless his mental estate, murderers such as Loeffner would be put to death, plain and simple. Moreover, in a biblical court of law, this would not be some long, drawn-out process over who knows how many years. Not according to Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and verse 11 and other passages as well. One more thought regarding our responsibility to bear arms in defense of others. Our responsibility, not our right, but our responsibility to bear arms in defense of others. Any weapon used in the responsible service of our responsibility, our biblical responsibility, is a defense weapon, not an assault weapon, as those on the far left want to make it. Loeffner's pistol, or his revolver, was not an assault weapon. Even Loeffner's weapon was not an assault weapon until he irresponsibly employed it in unlawfully taking or attempting to take the lives of others. And the weapon that the one of those who intervened was carrying, had it been used to shoot and kill Loeffner in the commission of his crimes, would not have been an assault weapon either. Any more than would have been a weapon used by policemen for the same reason had he happened to show up in time and actually intervened. And nobody, even the far left, is going to identify a policeman's weapon used in that fashion as an assault weapon. That's an argument that even the Second Amendment right guys ought to figure out and bring up sometime. And here's the irony. Had that man's concealed weapon been required to save Gabrielle Gifford's life, all of Gabby's friends, all of them, most of whom depict defense weapons as assault weapons, would have lauded the man, policeman or otherwise, for using his weapon to save her and others' lives. Shows the inconsistencies of those, particularly on the far left. Consequently, in light of all of this, in addition to recapturing our responsibilities versus our quote-unquote rights, we also need to recapture the term defense weapons versus assault weapons and not let them in any fashion use such except for somebody like Loeffner. And even more importantly, the most important lesson out of this particular message is that we also need to biblically capture, to biblically define the debate before entering it. Or we've lost the debate before we have engaged our opponent. Those things we must recapture. Those thoughts we must recapture on behalf of Christ and His kingdom. Why not? We have nothing to lose, but everything to gain. But we've got a long road to go with a lot of people who need to be convinced of the same. But that gives us all plenty to do, and we'll never have a lack of work therein. Let's stand. We'll close in prayer. Heavenly Father, once again, we thank you and we praise and glorify you for who you are, and Father, for everything that you do in our lives, particularly the salvation that you provided us by your grace and mercy and loving kindness in Yeshua the Christ, and the extended grace and mercy, Lord, toward us, Father, in our misunderstandings of the past. We're thankful, Lord, that you've allowed us to see, that you continue to allow us to see and understand your will more perfectly. We're thankful, Father, for these thoughts and pray that they would have an effect upon others as well. Open our hearts and minds, Lord, to your will in all things, to your praise and glory, and for the sake of advancing your kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. We ask these things and claim them in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.